accession number 12149. Reel 16.
Captain Sutton, reel 16.
He had celluloid film and he had a lovely fire. He destroyed nearly all the films, and we were extremely angry with him, having conducted a very dangerous operation and got the intelligence we were required to get, and then he destroyed it. So as we passed the Orkneys, we flew him ashore and marooned him there and left him. When we got back into the UK, we were given a really expert photographic officer who did this marvellous work for the rest of the commission. We did a series of operations against the Norwegian coast. The Germans were running supplies up and down Norway through the leads, channels inside the islands along the coast, and lying up in fjords during the daylight hours, and then proceeding very largely at night again along the leads. The southern part was looked after by the Air Force, usually using mosquitoes, attack mosquitoes, bombs and rockets, and the aircraft carriers took on the northern part of the coastline and did a series of operations to stop the German shipping. We conducted, I think it was, 3 or 4 attacks on the Norwegian coast. The last time we went up there, we flew the flag of the Commander-in-Chief, who was, I didn't realize at the time, was really trying us out to see that we were fully fit for a war service against the Japanese. That was Lord Fraser. He wasn't Lord at that time, Sir Bruce. Before Christmas, we came back towards the beginning of December, and the captain, who was the Mackintosh of Mackintosh, was relieved. He became a rear admiral and was relieved by a chap called Hughes Hallett, C.C. Hughes Hallett, Charles Hughes Hallett. There were 2 Hughes Halletts in the Navy. One liked them, which was Charles, the other one didn't, and that was his brother. And this was the most peculiar takeover of a warship. Much liked and respected captain, who had produced a very efficient warship, was seen over the side by a successor, and then all of us, all the heads of departments, were ordered to the captain's cabin, where we weren't offered chairs, but the captain then addressed us. He said that he was a gunnery officer, and he had a very considerable reputation as a brain. He'd been on the various planning committees that had gone to the States with Churchill and so on, and was a man of very high repute. But he wasn't a man of great common sense. He said that he was taking a command of a ship which had a great reputation. He didn't believe any reputations that were given to ships or to people until they'd been proved. He wasn't going to believe this reputation that this ship had until he'd proved her. He said that the Fleet Air Arm had sucked up a vast amount of the resources of the country and too much of the resources of the Navy, that they hadn't done anything worthwhile speaking about since the Battle of Taranto, and that he was going to see that his ship wasn't going to be a poor example. He was going to put things straight. So, as we left the captain's cabin, Charles Evans, who was quite a famous chap in his time, said to me out of the side of his mouth, he said, "You watch me fix this bastard." And this is it. Charles Evans was a man of great charm and great ability, and in no time he had trained and tamed Hughes Herriot. But Hughes Herriot was difficult. The first thing was that he had been to see the commander-in-chief before taking up his command, and had arranged that the ship was going to do an operation against Norway. There wasn't time to go up to the northern area because we were for Christmas, we were going to have Christmas leave, and we were due to sail for the Far East. We knew we were assigned to the Japanese War. I said, "Right, sir, I'll go ashore and get the intelligence." He said, "I've got the intelligence." I said, "Your job is operations officer to run the air operations. I have arranged all the intelligence that is necessary for this operation, and it is coming on board, and you are not to go and report to Commander Chief's headquarters." So I said, "Aye, sir." And then I said I wanted certain things. He said, "You've got all the information you require for this operation being sent on board. But luckily for me, I'd invited a wing commander, who I was friendly with up there, to come to sea with us and to watch the sea operation. And when we got to sea and he saw what we got, he said, 'For Christ's sake, why haven't you collected proper intelligence?' And I said, 'Well, this is what I've been gotten, I've been told.' And he said, 'Well, I've just done an operation down this coast in my mosquito wing.' And he then, from his own knowledge of the operation he'd done in a week before, he then briefed me on the situation, on the shipping situation and the aircraft situation and where the enemy airfields were and what was in them and everything else. He knew it, as a professional would. But that was my introduction to Hughes Herriot. I didn't like him as much as Mackintosh, as you can tell. I found that Hughes Herriot was a very difficult man. I also was a rather touchy young man. I'm now a touchy old man, but those days I was a very touchy young man. And he said to me that I was, in effect, the next junior lieutenant commander on board, and I was to take my turn at duty commanding officer with all the other lieutenant commanders. I said, "I am appointed your ship as a commander, sir, and I expect to be treated as a commander whilst I'm in your ship and in this appointment." And this is the sort of relationship we had, unfortunately. I didn't act as a duty lieutenant commander, and there it was. But it was not easy. We sailed in that operation. Again, I remember only too well that Harry smacked down, and again it hurts. Another one of the units that came under me was meteorology, the weather chaps. Because, of course, that all ties in with the design of operations. Another one of the things. And we were coming back, and there was a hell of an Atlantic gale, a regenerated hurricane, one of these ones that goes across the Atlantic and whips up round between Greenland and Iceland, and then comes across and hits the Norwegian coast. One of those was coming at us. And it was obvious it was heading right down to the south of Norway. And I suggested that if we did a leg to the north, then we would move into more or less into the Arctic High. We had come in behind the hurricane. Hughes Herriot said that it wasn't my job to order where the ship went. My job was to conduct the air operations. And that true naval officers don't avoid bad weather. You can see that we were on good personal terms by this time. And so he drew a straight line on the chart, which led from south of Norway, where we were, past the Orkneys down to Forsyth, where we were going to, and it took us right through the middle of this regenerated hurricane. And you know now, from what's been happening to North Sea oil rigs, what the weather can do to that area. One of the most instructive things I've ever seen in my life was the front end of the flight deck beaten up by the waves and starting to curl back like the tin of a sardine tin. That's what he did to the ship. And if he'd downlegged to the north, he'd have avoided lots of weather damage. As it is, he was a typical naval officer. I'm afraid this is the difference between a merchant navy officer to a naval officer. A naval officer tends to go along a straight line and say, that's that. The merchant navy will read the weather and conform to the weather. And he took us straight through some of the worst weather I've ever seen, and we went into Forsyth to be repaired for about 2 weeks while the ship was rebuilt forward. A leave over Christmas, and off we sailed after Christmas, being said goodbye to by the King and Queen. They came on board to cheer us on our way, and of course to raise the morale of the ship, because we were going off to war in the Pacific, whereas the war in the European theatre was coming to a halt. It was obvious that we were on the winning streak at home, and that it wasn't going to last all that much longer. We went out past through the Mediterranean. I can't remember if we put in at Gibraltar, but we were making as fast a passage as possible, and I have an idea that we didn't put in at Gibraltar. We were going to actually do I don't know. I can't remember. Maybe put in at Malta. I don't know. As we passed Crete, the captain said, well, thank God we can't be diverted there, but we haven't gotten any of the target intelligence. I said, oh, yes, we have, sir. I've got all the target intelligence. He said, what? I said, yes, I knew we were passing Crete, and therefore I got all the intelligence on board of the defences of Crete. And he was livid. He said, it's been known in the Admiralty we've got that intelligence, therefore we are liable to be diverted. I intend to make a fast passage out to the Pacific War, and now you've jeopardised my position. Well, let's face it, again, as operations officer, if we had passed Crete and we'd been ordered to go and attack and we hadn't got the intelligence on board, I'd have been court-martialed. But this is it, you see. The captain and I just did not see eye to eye in any bloody thing. Anyhow, we weren't ordered to divert and attack Crete. We went to port side, went through the Suez Canal, and like many ships before us, we went aground in the Suez Canal. When you're going through a big ship like that, trying to get through too fast, you get a peculiar effect called canal effect on a ship, and that makes the ship slice sideways, and we did just that into the side of the Suez Canal. But that didn't matter. We got off. They got tugs out to us and so on. Didn't damage the ship. I don't think we went to Aden, down to Colombo. And we stayed in Colombo in the ship, and I went ashore to the airfield Trincomalee. We were adjusting the squadrons to operating in the tropics. There were all sorts of things to do with that. First of all, you tropicalize the aircraft. They have all sorts of different equipment on them, different filters, etc. But also, you have jungle training camps, you have escape and evasion in a new area, you have all sorts of things like that. You don't just switch from the operations against Norway to operations against the Japanese in the tropics in a thing like that, or you shouldn't. So we were ashore for, I suppose, a couple of weeks probably in Ceylon, adjusting and tropicalizing the personnel and the aircraft and the equipment. And then crossed the Indian Ocean to Perth, around the south of Australia to Sydney. And Sydney, a fairly short period in harbour, and then we went out to try our teeth on the Japanese. Now, it's a psychological thing in warfare that you've got to know the enemy and size them up the one you're fighting, and there was a certain apprehension about the Japanese. They weren't behaving in a civilized way. They beheaded airmen when they captured them. They didn't treat you as a human being. If you were captured, you were treated as the merest, lowest grade of coolie. We didn't like the Japanese. When you, as we had at that stage, a lot of very young aircraft coming on board, you've got to put them through a psychological barrier. And we did it, not our intention, but it was designed by Bruce Fraser, who had become a commander-in-chief out there. You can see why he was trying us out as a ship before he sent us out, because he was going to take command of the Pacific. We went out and attacked the Fortress Island Truk, great fortress island which the Japanese had established between the two wars, and which had become isolated away from the rest of the Japanese. The rest of them were withdrawn, and there was this fortress archipelago. So we attacked Truk, and it's one of these things about airmen. Once you've flown over enemy territory and attacked the enemy, then he's no longer the superman he was. You've got away with it. And so we did this with our squadrons, all our young new squadrons went in at a Truk and attacked there. And again, gradually working up to the full operations which we were going to off Japan, you're conducting in a different way. You're going to be operating under the Americans. The Americans had a complete organization of recognition and where you flew, how you approached ships, what happened if you came down. You were picked up by a submarine, but you had to do certain things. All sorts of things are taught, but you can't teach them all at one go. You gradually bring it in. Then we moved up to Manus, which is in the Admiralty Islands to the north of Australia, and had become the forward naval base for the British Pacific Fleet operating against Japan. And from there, we operated up with the Pacific Fleet. I think it was the Illustrious we were relieved. They had four fleet carriers on station the whole time. There were six fleet carriers always in the theatre, so there was probably one going up and one coming back and four on station. And joining in with the American fleet, in general, what happened was that we were by this stage, in the last stages of the war, we're talking of June, July, I suppose, of 45, we were operating against the mainland of Japan. We went up there in time for things like Okinawa and so on. It was right at the tail end of the war. We were pounding Japan to pieces. We were going after target system, softening it up, ready for invasion. It was realized that there would be a suicide battle on the beaches if this happened, and so thing after thing was being done to make the Japanese less efficient. You went after their communication system. you knocked out every bit of the radio system, equipment industry. You did that, in actual fact, by going in for the valve factories. In those days, it was still valves. It wasn't transistors and things. Valves. So if you did that, you knocked out radar, you knocked out radio, and you made it impossible to control the tank forces, the air forces, the things. So you went for a particular bit of a particular system. We knocked out the steel industry because the ships and the tanks and the guns are made of steel. But you went for a particular thing. We went for the coking industry for the steel mills, and most of the coal in Japan came from the northern island of Hokkaido, and so we sank the ferries coming across from Hokkaido, the specialized coal ferries, and we then knocked out all the coal transporter equipments around in various ports with the big long conveyor things, knocked them all out around the coasts, so that you knocked out the coal industry so they couldn't move down the coal to the steel mills. And you went on like this. This was American intelligence, American design of the operations. We were being conducted completely as part of the whichever fleet it was, the, you know, whichever commander-in-chief was in command in America. The fleet name changed, and I think it was Halsey when we were there. It then became, I think it was the Fifth Fleet. So we acted as a unit under the Americans. The Americans always had three carrier groups up there, and the fourth carrier group was provided by the British. So that makes 16 carriers. I'm not certain there weren't 20 carriers. Maybe the Americans had four carrier groups. I can't remember. Anyhow, it was a massive force. The British had armored decks and had been proven time and again from the bombing of Elastrian onwards that these ships survived. The Americans didn't. The Americans believed that having many more aircraft and being able to fight in the air, the British armored their decks and could take punishment and went on fighting even if they were damaged. It's a matter of taking money and
making
a choice. But it had been proved, in actual fact, the indefatigable had been hit on her armored flight deck in the attacks on Okinawa. And within 2 hours, she was back in operations again, whereas the Americans wouldn't have been back inside 6 weeks. They'd have swept off the mess off the flight deck. A lot of people killed and so on, but they got back into operation. We operated up and down the coast of Japan. The main attacks were on airfields. We were trying to gain complete air superiority in preparation for the invasion of Japan, which was scheduled for November 1945. The Japanese pulled back their aircraft over the central ridge of mountains into the Japan Sea side of Japan, the Inland Sea. And so that they had a certain, they had their anti-aircraft guns and a few aircraft on the eastern side of Japan, the side we were attacking from, but not a terrific amount. Now, we were taking out all the Japanese airfield down the eastern coast. The Americans laid down for each series of operations a complete schedule of airfields that would be taken out by each particular carrier group. Then the carrier group admiral, in our case, Philip Vian, allocated the airfields be taken out to the various carriers, and you then work through the day taking those out to a schedule. Now, this was very cleverly worked out, that you would knock out the whole of the Japanese Air Force. But you started off by attacking a particular airfield, which you had never seen before, which you hadn't got any intelligence on. Well, you maybe you had an intelligence planned of it, but you hadn't seen what was on it now. And then there were a series of other airfields which you were to attack in turn, but you were also given told that if the first one was impossible to attack, covered in cloud or something else, then you were given alternatives. And so you worked right through the day progressing the series of airfields. Now, what we did in Implacable was that we attacked the first airfield of the day. We then swept over the next targets. We had fitted our aircraft, the Seafires particularly, with vertical cameras. They also had gun cameras as well, so they could identify what we're attacking. But they had vertical cameras. So you swept over. What we do was to sweep over the area, take photographs of the succeeding targets, bring them back on board, have them rapidly developed, and so that they were available, wet prints were available for the next sortie that went off. So every pilot that went off onto the next sortie had a picture of the airfield he was going to attack, and particular things were marked on it as targets or as dummies. Particularly, the Japanese were terribly good at making dummies and attracting you down into decoys where they had guns and things to knock you out. So we did very well. We worked round. We knew that a particular airfield might have anything attractive on it, but we did actually fly over it to see whether there was anything attackable, and then we would proceed, if necessary, to the secondary airfield or the third airfield and attack that. The result was that we had an incredibly high rate of kills of enemy aircraft. This isn't my idea. This was the way that the Air Force operated at the tail end of the war against the Germans in Europe. And we adapted it for carrier use. But it hadn't been done by the other carriers. And it wasn't understood, unfortunately, by Vian. We got a terrific rate of kill. And we identified that the aircraft actually were being killed, that they were true, by taking front camera gun shots. You've seen these pictures of these things.
Yes.
And you could then identify that what you actually had attacked was either a disabled aircraft been put up on trestles or a thing made of bamboo or whatever else it was, or a real aircraft. So there was, during the day, a series of attacks. Then at the evening, we would report what we had done, and then we would verify it, nearly always downwards, because it was proved that a certain number of the attacks had been, despite all our warnings and all the rest of it, had been on dummies. So that you would say that, in actual fact, the original claim.